the Fan.
Hey, what's up, man?
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying.
I think anyone who puckers up their lips and presses it against their boss's buttocks and then smooches is an ass kisser.
I seem to be inept at everything except my work. I'm good at my work, so I confine myself to that. All I want out of life is a 30 share and a 20 rating.
The man's enlarged my mind. He's a poet, warrior in the classic sense. I'm a little man. He's a great man.
Think of it as colors. There's black and there's white. And in between is mostly gray. That's us. Now, gray is a tough color because it's not as simple as black and white. And for the media, certainly not as interesting. But it's who we are.
Football leader, fan radio network.
What do you mean?
And KFAN.com. 2 minutes, 5 seconds past the hour of 3 Central Standard Time. We welcome you back. Bumper to Bumper is the name of the show. It is a 3.5 hour tour. I wish it was longer today. I really, really do. On a calm before the weekend snownami Wednesday afternoon in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. My name is Dan Barrero. I host the program. Gardzi is the producer. Thank you for your participation in today's festivities. Bort and Volvo guest lineup is outstanding today, if I do say so myself, and I will. I don't have the horn sounder to blow as of noon three guy. Well, that's a different horn. That'll work.
That'll be ours for the show today.
Maybe that'll be ours for today. And we'll give you that lineup in just a couple of minutes. We'll set the tone early today. Brad Sean Brian Inbox will be rebooted. I haven't done that yet for a very specific reason, which I'll get to a little bit later. But you still can reach us, even if it hasn't been rebooted, via booth at KFAN.com, B-O-O-T-H at KFAN.com. You can reach us via Twitter, too, Dan Barrero KFAN, JG KFAN. Either, we take a look at what comes in during the show from our Twitter accounts. That's okay, too. It's another way for, maybe it's easier for some people to go that route as opposed to emailing. I mentioned off the top of the program that we are indeed your, did we fumble the nuclear football leader? You're familiar, Gardzi, with the nuclear football?
I think I am.
How do I best describe the nuclear football, as I understand it, is the briefcase that holds the keys to nuclear war.
Mm.
That's pretty serious stuff.
You would think so.
Very, very sobering stuff to think about. And, of course, post-World War II, I don't believe we've ever used those codes. I think we thought about it maybe a couple of times, but we never have. But there's a longstanding tradition when one president leaves and another president comes in, as just is taking place or has taken place earlier today. Right now, we got a parade going down, going on in Washington. Not obviously any very few spectators, if any. We already saw. I saw the president. I think the president's already in the White House now. I saw him go through the big front door.
Okay.
With his family, and now
there's
Vice President Harris and her husband. And other dignitaries now are on that same sort of walk. And as they look to their right, they are waving at people. So I don't know who got clearance to be those people. because security has been exceedingly tight, as most of you know. But as I understand it, one of the traditions is the instead of the passing of the baton, it's the passing of the nuclear football briefcase. Have you seen the briefcase, by the way?
Well, I just looked it up because I wasn't quite sure what you were talking about. Yeah. It's a prodigious briefcase.
It's absolutely considerable.
Yeah.
I mean, you gotta pretty much be built like Mayo Clinic Big Knocker to even hold that thing up.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not any question about that. You gotta be buffed to be able to not have your arm just drag down to the ground and just drag it along the floor. It's considerable. And I'm looking at, this is a piece from the right-leaning Washington Examiner. Trump's early morning departure from the White House hours prior to Biden's inauguration interrupts the process by which one president takes custody of the codes. Now, there's been a lot of discussion about the other rules, written and unwritten, that have been violated by the president leaving early, right, and getting on a plane to go to Florida, basically meaning that the highest ranking official from his administration to be on the inauguration dais, as we like to say in the business, was the vice president, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's all other kinds of protocol where I think even from the Capitol, where one first family or, you know, husband and wife stand up there for a while, the outgoing with the incoming,
right,
and they exchange pleasantries.
Yep. And then greet them,
and then eventually the outgoing ones get shoved down the stairs by the ones who are just coming in. Right, it's part of the tradition,
more or less.
That, of course, a bit of history has also been broken once again because President Trump, now former President Trump, couldn't handle it. He just couldn't. He too big of a baby. So, this is, I think, a hidden one that kind of interested me because there hasn't been as much attention paid to it. According to this piece, there will be no nuclear fumble, though, on Inauguration Day. Trump's unconventional exit might be eye-catching, but his last breach of protocol doesn't create any substantive interference with the process. This might be my favorite quote of the day from the Heritage Foundation's James Carafano. We've been doing presidential nuclear command and control for a long, long time now. There's all kinds of different contingencies, and so they're well prepared for that, as if it's all symbolic. It's not that big of a deal. The transfer customarily takes place during the ceremony at high noon. As former Vice President Dick Cheney recalled in 2013, when the military aide tasked with carrying the football under the outgoing president's hands, or I should say, carrying the football, hands it to his own successor. The outgoing president hands it to his own successor. Quote, these two guys are standing there in their uniforms, and at the right moment, he reaches over and hands it to the newly designated military aide, and he takes it from that moment on. The new president is the guy who's in control of our nuclear assets. So technically, I don't know that any president has ever had to carry the codes.
No.
I don't know if they're not strong enough or if it's just assumed we got a minion for that. We got somebody who'll do that, but ceremonially it's now you're carrying the briefcase, the nuclear football, for the new guy.
Yeah.
Right?
What the presidents get apparently is some kind of, they call it a biscuit. It's like a plastic card,
okay,
that has numbers on it that identify them as the individual that's in charge.
Okay.
If they need to use the codes.
Speaking, I'm glad you brought up the biscuit.
Thank you.
The system isn't wholly immune to human error or presidential forgetfulness. Bill Clinton, in his haste to leave a 1999 NATO summit, left the event without the military aide in the motorcade. A relatively small matter, given that the event was within walking distance of the White House. A second incident, however, unfolded for months in secret when Clinton actually lost the biscuit. He misplaced the biscuit.
Can't do that.
Please, no Monica Lewinsky jokes here. The card that contains the codes required to authenticate any order that comes from the president. The codes were actually missing for months. Retired Army General Hugh Shelton, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in Clinton's second term, wrote in a 2010 memoir, "We called upstairs. We started a search around the White House for the codes, and he finally confessed that he, in fact, misplaced them. He couldn't recall when he had last seen them. The good news is they saw this coming. The people, the smart people behind the scenes, they said, sooner or later, a president's going to lose the biscuit. So what does that mean? That means that can't be the only biscuit. There's got to be another biscuit, right? And sure enough, a second football is kept close to the vice president, while a backup resides at the White House, according to something called the Atomic Heritage Foundation. Biden is expected to receive one of these alternative nuclear footballs, while Trump's codes will indeed expire. So there you have it. I didn't know about the biscuit part until I read it today. So it's interesting that you brought that up. And I don't remember hearing that Bill lost the biscuit.
That's kind of on brand, doesn't it seem like?
Yeah, very much so.
I can see W losing it too. Like, there's guy. I can see all of them losing it.
But how embarrassing is it when you start opening? You know, you're in the Oval Office and you start opening doors.
you're going through drawers,
or maybe you're in there and somebody else comes in, and Mr. President, what are you missing something? Do you tell them right away, or do you go, it's no big deal, I'll just keep looking? At what point do you have to admit, it's not like I lost my wallet?
Or my keys.
If presidents even carry keys, or, you know, any of the things that the rest of us lose, I can't remember where I put the biscuit.
Well, that is what's funny, is presidents, I don't think anymore, carry anything. You know, they've got so many aides that carry everything for them.
Very true.
And they don't really need their wallet, obviously, right? I don't think they really need a phone all that much. So, like, that's what we give them? Like, we give them one thing?
A little biscuit. Well, but you know what? If the biscuit's too big, it's unwieldy.
Yeah.
I wonder what the size... Does your story indicate the size of the biscuit?
It doesn't. It just says it's a small plastic card. So okay. I feel like it's no bigger than a credit
card
or a
license.
It's got
to be like a credit card. Yeah. Maybe it does need to be a little bit bigger.
You would think so.
Maybe that's the problem. Because it's not like you got to carry it around in your wallet. Well, I wonder what it... Like, when the president goes on the road... Or give speeches or whatever, does he have to carry the biscuit in his pocket?
I would think so.
Like in his sport coat?
And
his suit jacket?
You just put on your nightstand every night when you empty out your pockets and you've got your phone and you're charging it and your pens and the loose change and everything, and then you just throw the biscuit right there in the nightstand too? It's bizarre.
Quite a historic day for reasons that go beyond the changing of power between Trump and Joseph Biden. We're going to give you details on that in our guest lineup in a minute, because they're all kind of related. But first,
opportunity to put a grand in your hand, and dollar is the first keyword of the show. Text dollar to 200-200 to enter our national cash contest. Standard text message and data rates may apply. Text dollar to 200.
On the Fan.
There are two title round games scheduled for Sunday. Both of them can be heard on our flagship FM 100.3, The Fan. The NFC title game is first, and then, of course, the Kansas City Chiefs and the Buffalo Bills. And many of you probably know that in the opener, Tom Brady will be matched against Aaron Rodgers, a name pretty familiar to, well, really both names are familiar to Vikings fans, but especially A-Rodge. Gary Myers is, I think, feeling lucky these days and grateful that Tom Brady is still alive, because he's got a podcast out these days, this year, started I think in mid-October, called The GOAT. And the longer one would assume that the Tampa Bay Buccaneers win, that means Brady is on the field for the next game, and the last game be the Super Bowl, and everybody wins, including Gary Myers, kind enough to join us. So do you feel lucky to that extent? Because, you know, I mean, he could be eliminated already.
Did you pick out that music I was listening to?
Well, it's we have like a whole library of bumper-to-bumper songs, and that's one of them that is on my list, yes. But I didn't select it today necessarily for you.
Oh, it was so mellow. It was very unlike you.
Well, a lot of the songs, believe it or not, that we play are more mellow than what is supposed to be customary on, you know, sports talk shows.
It's for balance with the host, Gary. That's why we do that.
We
mellow him. We try to mellow him. If I incite him with different music, it gets even worse.
We have, go ahead.
I know, it's good. I really liked it, and I was hoping you weren't going to start talking.
Well, I think a lot of people have said that to me from time to time in our audience. But I mean, you know, at some point they force me to, and I got to do it. And I love. Besides that, I love the sound of my own voice, as you well know.
Well, I know that. I sat next to you in Dallas for a lot of
years. Yeah, there was
shut up.
Well, let's just say I wouldn't exactly call you a shy New Yorker.
No.
By any stretch of there was no contradiction there. All right, so on that point, I mean, yeah, you're living good, right? I mean, Braid, this is the ultimate matchup, right? Because, let's be honest, Breeze, we saw. I think it was revealed last week, and you can speak to this, I guess. Pretty close to done or maybe overdone. Aaron Rodgers is not close to being done. In fact, he may have had his best year yet.
Yeah, I mean, getting back to your original point, I mean, I never root for anybody to win or lose.
Right.
I mean, we kind of get trained that way in this business, but it certainly is to my advantage that the Bucs are still playing rather than having been eliminated a couple of weeks ago. I'm still taping some, we're calling them bonus episodes now, that are more in real time because the podcast, the first 12 episodes of the podcast were really just a retrospective on Brady's life and mm-hmm. his career. And the last four that I've done have been more about what's happened this season. So it's been fun. The new one is going to be posted sometime later today, and I have Al Michaels and Peter King as interviews that I did that I kind of put in there throughout the narrative, and it's pretty entertaining, especially Al. Al's a really, I used to work with Al on Monday Night Football. I don't know. I think I probably told you that.
Sure, absolutely.
Over the years,
but, yeah, right.
Yeah, for about 10 years, and he and I are really good friends. And he's, other than you, he's the smartest guy I know in this business. And he's so entertaining, which is where he's different from you.
That's kind of uncalled for. When you're funny, I'll laugh.
Okay. So I have him and Peter King on this episode. Just they both know Brady and Rogers really well, and so I thought they were really insightful. And I taped the episode. This afternoon with my other eye on the inauguration.
Sure.
One of the great days in the history of our country, but that's another matter entirely. So, last week I was really disappointed that Drew Brees just looked really done.
Yeah.
And I know his wife put something out today detailing a lot of the injuries that he had this year, a shoulder injury that I don't know that anybody knew about. And I mean, he just looked ready to call it a career. And Tom is still playing like he's 33 instead of 43, and Aaron's playing like he's 27 and not 37. So I really think this is one of these games, Dan, that you just kind of need to realize as it's happening that this is really a game for the ages,
mm-hmm.
maybe a game for the aged also, and just embrace it because these are two of the greatest quarterbacks of all time playing in an NFC championship game. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. No, you're 100% right. And I don't know what you thought. I didn't think Brady was great last week. I thought he was efficient when they got the ball off the turnovers, but that they needed the turnovers. They were not going to win that game without the turnovers. He made enough plays. And that's why to me, you know, this sounds odd because what else does he have to prove? But to me, it would be another pretty crowning achievement if he goes to Green Bay and outduels Rodgers, who's had a ridiculous season. Now you could say Brady's had a ridiculous half season. The second half, his numbers are as good as anybody's. But obviously, Rodgers right now, it's like, well, he's still viewed as more in his prime, and Brady's just making enough plays. You go there and you win that game. You outduel him at the quarterback position. It's another notch. I mean, I don't know how many. He doesn't need any more notches, but to me, it would be another fairly remarkable thing to add to the list.
Without question. And, you know, as far as what happened the other day in New Orleans, he's had trouble all three times with the Saints defense. That was kind of his kryptonite this season. Sure, to go to Green Bay and win this game, and the Bucs, I mean, the Bucs of all teams becoming the first team to play the Super Bowl on their home field. The Vikings came really close a few years ago. But, you know, for the Bucs to do it, you know, the losingest team in the history of sports. For the first time in 55 years, a team gets to play the Super Bowl on its home field, and it's the Tampa Bay Bucks. He has transformed the image of that organization in 4 months, which is unbelievable. I mean, they were
just
a bunch of misfits, right? And and now he's playing great, although the quality of the competition, up until the Saints game, during the six-game winning streak, they beat Atlanta twice, Detroit, Carolina, and Washington. Not exactly, you know, murderous row there. The Saints, because, you know, Breeze just seemed so compromised, they weren't the same team they were when they beat the Bucks 38-3 in early November. So even that came a lot easier than I thought. I mean, I didn't know if they were going to win the game, but I certainly didn't think they were going to win by 10. And like you said, without the turnovers, they wouldn't have won at all. A couple things about the game in Green Bay. Brady obviously is used to playing in the cold. He was at Michigan for 5 years and New England for 20. Although I would guess that a majority of the Bucks are not from Florida.
Right.
They have been playing and living in Florida
since
early August.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always a shock to the body. And listen, you guys know it, living in Minneapolis. It's not like it's a winter travel destination, being in New York, you know, if you're coming for warm weather. But when I went to Green Bay for the 07 NFC Championship game between the Giants and the Packers, that was cold that I've never experienced in my life. I think the temperature was actually minus one, and the wind chill was minus 23 at kickoff.
Oof.
The advantage for the Bucks on Sunday is that Central Time, it's a 2 o'clock kickoff. That Giant Packer game was a 5:20 Central kickoff. So at least the Bucks get the afternoon, and maybe there'll be some sun.
At least daylight, yeah, right.
Yeah, and so I think that works to their advantage. But, I mean, can you just imagine if it's really cold there? You know, Mike Evans sticking his hands in his pouch, and Chris Godwin and those guys who aren't used to this.
No,
absolutely. I do want to just add this in here. The Giants, Eli Manning, beat Brett Favre in the NFC Championship game at Lambeau Field and beat Aaron Rodgers in the divisional round at Lambeau Field. That might have been Rodgers' best team in 2011,
coming off
their Super Bowl. They were 15-1.
Yeah.
And a very average team went in there and beat them. And now the Bucks, who I think are better than those Giant teams were, maybe not defensively, but certainly offensively, are going into Lambeau, Dan, without the fans. And the whole mystique of the Packers, those fans are so loyal and so loud, and it is such a cool stadium that I think just loses its mystique when the stands are empty. And again, that works to the Bucks' advantage.
It does. Now, there will be some fans. They've had fans there. That I don't know what the number is.
Right?
Like 6,000-7,000. I don't know if they're upping that at all. But I get your point. Is it enough to where you're going to get the feel that you would if that place, because we've both been there, when that place is full and rocking the whole bit? You know, on the whole Brady run, he obviously gets separated from or divorced from his guy, from Belichick and New England. Mm-hmm. And everybody was kind of waiting. Well, who's going to need who more? And we probably got a pretty good handle on that already. But to me, the larger question on Brady continues to be whether his ability to continue to play it at such a high level and now in a new place without really missing a beat is a function of we're just seeing a generational talent here, or we're seeing a guy who is symptomatic of the time in that he takes care of his body so much better than, you know, quarterbacks did 20, 30, 40 years ago, that's as big a part of it as it is just the fact that he's just so damn good. What do you think? What is it that allows him to continue to flourish?
Well, I think at this age, you'd have to certainly say that the way he takes care of his body, both working out and nutritionally, I didn't know if I read this anywhere, but I thought it was really interesting. As he walked off the field in New Orleans the other day, the first guy he saw before he headed up the tunnel was Alex Guerrero, you know, who is his nutritional and body coach, I guess you'd say. And whereas Belichick pushed him away. I just think Tom's getting to what he want, do what he wants to do in Tampa. And, you know, Bruce Arians even talked the other day about how he's allowing him to coach with something that Belichick never allowed him to do. He doesn't have generational, like, ability.
Mm-hmm.
Aaron Rodgers does. So I wouldn't say he's a generational talent. He's a generational winner. And I think what it's proved, the whole Belichick-Brady argument, I think what this year has proved is a great coach cannot win with a crappy quarterback, but a great quarterback can win with an average coaching staff.
Mm.
And because I don't think a lot of Bruce Arians.
I'm with you on
the
that.
First half of the season, the first half, I didn't know what he was doing.
Yeah.
The first half of, or the first three quarters of the season until the bye week, he was just making Tom drop back five steps and just chuck it down the field, which has never been his game.
No.
I think they're in that bye week, which came late for them, and they haven't lost since then. I think they probably went over the tape of all the games, the first 12 games, and said, okay, this is working, we'll keep that. This isn't working, we're going to throw this out. And most of what they threw out was Arians' offense, and most of what they kept was Brady's offense, and they've won six in a row. So, but I think, you know, Dan, if we sat here before the season and say, okay, Brady or Belichick, one of them is going to get to the conference championship game and the other one's not going to make the playoffs, which is which? I think we probably would have agreed that the Bucs had a better chance than Belichick, because the talent level in New England is really bad. And I don't mean to say that, you know, Cam Newton is a crappy quarterback. He just played crappy this year. It really proves the two most important people in the organization, and I've said this forever, are the coach and the quarterback.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to win unless you really have elite people at both those spots. I think what's happened in Tampa this year is that, you know, Todd Bowles is a pretty good defensive coordinator, and Tom now is coaching the offense, not Arians. And I really believe that. And with Tom taking over now and running what he wants to run, he's able to get by. I mean, he's probably a better coach than Arians is anyhow. And, you know, he's got all these years of experience running the offense that he's most comfortable in, so it was probably smart on Arians' part to defer to him a little bit.
Last item for you. As it pertains to what ended up unraveling or has unraveled in New England, you know, on the one hand, you could argue it's inevitable. I mean, you can't be great forever. Some stuff caught up with them. They're not picking high in the draft. So it's going to happen. It's going to run its course. On the other hand, I say to myself, well, if Brady, I look back at what Brady had the last few years, and I can't help but think that it's kind of criminal that it came to this, because clearly Brady had another one or two runs in him. But he probably, I think, as we've talked about before with you on the show, looked up and said, I'm not going to, I'm getting tired of having to do this with a bunch of nobodies. If I can, you know, at the end here, get with some legitimate talent, I'm going to do it that way. So how do we explain that part of the Belichick failure, as sacrilegious as it is to say failure, because he's obviously got an unbelievable record?
I think that's a major reason why he left. Combined with the fact that he never was really paid a market value contract, because he bought into the whole idea, leave some money on the table and we're going to keep the rest of the team competitive so you can keep going to Super Bowls. And I think that worked for a lot of years. And he wasn't getting there with a great roster around him. There were just enough good players that he was able to raise their level. But In 2019, I think, is where he really got disgusted. He probably only knew the name of one receiver, and that was Edelman.
Yeah.
You know, Gronk was gone, and he had no one to throw the ball to. And he goes, what am I doing all this sacrificing here and giving up all this money, and Belichick is not even using it to help us win? I don't understand what happened, why he let the roster get to that point when his quarterback – was not making $30 million a year like yours is. and
that's uncalled. That's an uncalled for cheap shot.
But it's accurate, isn't
it? That's true, yeah. Can't argue with that.
So the other part about this, and I've heard Tom talk about this season, I really think after all these years, the California guy was tired of the of the snow and the cold in New England, and you know he's renting Derek Jeter's house until he might have moved into his new one.
Yeah,
each of them are right on the water. He posed in front of this boat that he bought about 2 months ago. That was just unbelievable. I think he's really enjoying this change in lifestyle. And he said he would never live in the Northeast again. I know he's got a place in Manhattan that they were in the process of selling. You know, the one thing where Brady's been able to take less money, Dan, he has got turned it into an art form, flipping real estate properties.
Really?
He built a house in, I forget what town it was, in L.A. It was one of the really nice suburbs, not Manhattan Beach, but I don't remember. But they built a house there, and they lived in it for about 3 years in the off-season, and he made a ton of money when he sold it.
Turn it around, huh? Yeah.
And I know he's trying to do that with his house in New England. I'm not sure if he sold it yet, but you know he built it. And they didn't move into it until like 2014, so he only lived there about 5 years. And it was right next door, literally next door to Robert Kraft's house.
Cool.
I mean, they can just, I mean, each one of them had a ton of property.
Yeah.
But I figured if it wasn't the middle of March when he went to tell Kraft that he wasn't coming back, he would have just walked over there. It's that close, but in the summertime, it would have been fine. In the winter, he probably drove, but, they live right next door to each other, which is kind of bizarre.
Well, I'm assuming that'll be once he retires. He'll have his own reality TV show, you know, some sort of a house flipping program as well. We're against the clock because I got another guest.
Go ahead.
I'm looking forward to this game. I am, for all the reasons you lay out.
You too.
Don't forget Tom Brady, the GOAT, the Myers podcast. It's available on the iHeart app. It's available everywhere where you get your podcast. We like to make a big deal about the fact that it's on iHeart Radio for all the obvious reasons, and so get to it early and often. Sounds like you got some new, fresh interviews there, including with Al Michaels, who we've had on a few times and is always a great guest. We will stay in touch before the Super Bowl because we didn't even get to the Hall of Fame stuff, so I want to do that next time we're on as well.
Yeah, we had our meeting yesterday. It was only about eight and a half hours.
Sounds like a meat grinder. We'll get to that next.
I wish Zoom has like a two-hour limit.
Yeah, good point. Thanks, Myers.
See you later.
Be good. Gary Myers, formerly New York Daily News. We're going to come back and be joined, go in a completely different direction. Jimmy Jam is going to join us as we celebrate the fact that 50 years ago today, the single that starts every episode of the Bumper to Bumper show, the Marvin Gaye classic, What's Going On, was released. And turns out that's the album that was a part of is Jimmy's favorite album of all time. So we're going to celebrate that together.
Making all them excuses, well, you're better off alone. Think he's fly, cause he drive a 600 that he don't even own. Talking like he the guy, he could buy heaven, any girl he won't.
Tonight's show.
He don't know nothing about it.
I feel rude interrupting.
I wanted you to get to the chorus there, yeah.
I'll shut up for a minute.
Some harmony for you.
Tonight's show, Monday night, just this past Monday night. Our next guest, Terry Lewis and Babyface, performed their recent single called He Don't Know Nothing About It. And Jimmy is kind enough, on very short notice, to join us on this Wednesday afternoon. Jimmy, how are you?
I'm good, Dan, and I have to tell you, I'm so glad that you said the title correctly. He don't know nothing about it. Because everybody goes about it.
Yeah.
It's like, no, it's not about it.
That's wrong.
About it. He don't know nothing about it.
That's
so you
it.
You got it. You nailed it.
I jumped in a little too soon before the chorus. I blew that, and I was trying to atone for that mistake, and then it's like, well, but I don't want to keep him on hold forever. He's a busy man, even though he probably doesn't mind listening to his own music, but he's probably heard it before too, I'm guessing. But
I've definitely heard it a few times, but I actually like it, and I'd say to people all the time, that ask, how do you know when a song's done? And it's when I can listen to the song without hearing all the mistakes.
Right?
Because as you're working on it, and it's not quite done, you keep going, oh, we can fix that, oh, we can make that better, we can make that better. This song is one that I can honestly listen to, and I don't hear the mistakes anymore. I just enjoy listening to it.
So that's good to hear.
Thanks for playing it. Yeah,
I think they call that the tortured artist effect, right? Where, the rest of us, if we like a song, we don't know what went into it. We only know the finished product, and we like it. Meanwhile, the tortured artist goes, yeah, but if I had to do over, I would have done this, or we could have done that, or we could have done that thing. I assume you could drive yourself crazy that way.
Yeah, absolutely. It happens exactly like that. Although, as I've gotten more, mature, I guess, or older, or whatever you want to call it, I think I'm aware of it now. So I now try to just listen and just enjoy the songs, But I definitely have that. There's still some songs today that still drive me crazy that I'm going, man, I wish we could have done that over.
Any you want to name? Get it off your, off your chest. Get it out of your system. It might unburden you.
Yeah, no, I'm not gonna. I don't even want to think that way. I'm gonna think positive today. Yep. But I will tell you the one song. And somebody that when people ask favorite song that we've ever been involved with, and it's Optimistic by the Sounds of Blackness.
Mm-hmm.
And for very many reasons, but that song to me is a song that was probably one of the first songs I remember getting that feeling of I didn't hear a mistake when I listened to it. So I was able to hear it the way that everybody else heard it and really feel uplifted by it every time I hear it. So I'll stick on the positive side of things. That's my favorite one.
That's fair enough. What's it like perform? I mean, you like I said, you're on the Tonight Show in a studio on Monday night. So is this the start of a whole new, I guess you could say, chapter for you guys, or where are we headed here?
Yeah, well, it's a really long chapter. I'll try to make it short. When we 35 years ago, we were working on an album called Control that you'll remember we recorded in Minneapolis with Janet Jackson, and right before we had started working on that album, we had started working on a Jam and Lewis album, and so we had gotten all our not all of our songs done, but we had got a bunch of tracks done. And so when John McClain, who was the A&R person at A&M Records, he came up to hear what we had done with Janet for Control. And we played him Control and Nasty and Pleasure Principle. And we played him all the songs, right? And we said, how's it sound? And he said, like all A&R people at record companies used to do, he would go, I just need one more. So we go, what are you talking about, right? So anyway, we went riding around. I remember we were going to go to Rudolph's Barbecue. And Terry puts a cassette in, and he goes, John, listen to this. This is our album that we're working on. And about the third song in, John goes, that's the one I need for Janet. So the next day we went to the studio. We put it in. We didn't even tell her we were going to play anything. We just put the song on. When it ended, she said, who's that for? And we said, you if you want it. And she said, I want it. That song became What Have You Done For Me Lately. So it basically ended our career, at least as artists, and started hers. And over the 35 years, we would try to make records with other folks, and they'd always want to keep the songs for themselves. 3 years ago, we got inducted in the Songwriters Hall of Fame when they asked us, what was it that we'd like to do that we haven't done yet? And we said, we'd still like to make our own album. And that now brings us to today. And Babyface actually got inducted the same year that we did. And we said, we should do a song together. Let's work together. And so that's kind of the culmination of a 35-year story. So, yes, we are planning on doing this. This is what's kind of consuming our 20. It consumed a lot of our 2020, a lot of our, and will consume a lot of our 2021. And we have an album coming out in June with a whole bunch of different artists. And that's kind of what we're doing.
That's a great summation. You distilled the essence of that very, very nicely. And we look forward to talking to you when the entire album comes out as well. As you know, I reached out to you today because I had been reminded I'm a big anniversary guy. I'm sucker for big anniversaries. I just am, especially on this show, because it gives us an excuse to go back and talk about things I like to talk about. And in this case, it's the 50th anniversary of the single from the What's Going On album. The song What's Going On was released 50 years ago today. Now, there's a little controversy about that. Some people say it's Jan 31. Others say Jan 20. But the bottom line is we're celebrating it today because the state of Michigan is officially recognizing Jan 20 as What's Going On Day in honor of the 50th anniversary of the release of that single. And I maybe had forgotten that over the years we had talked about your own appreciation of the album. I couldn't remember, but I thought, okay, who can I reach out to short notice? And I've immediately thought of you, and I said, well, maybe he's too young. I don't know, or maybe it's not, doesn't have to be in everybody's wheelhouse, because it's always been my favorite album. And you immediately texted back, you're kind of preaching to the choir. It's my favorite album of all time as well. And I said, bingo, we've hit the jackpot. And so here we are. Why is it your favorite album of all time?
Well, it just is, first of all, from just a sonic impact of it. There's a lot of times, and of course in these days that we're living in now, people always talk about protest songs, and they talk about songs that are kind of the day. And the thing that was always unique about that record, because I told a couple of people that were working on some songs, during, kind of the turbulent 2020, that sometimes music can be an escape for people. You want to hear the commentary on what's going on, but you also want to kind of be, whatever music does, soothes you or whatever that is. So Marvin was able to take lyrically lyrics that were very important and very relevant to the times that were not necessarily positive, uplifting lyrics, but he was able to sing them almost like a lullaby, where if you're listening to the song sonically, it makes you feel good. It makes you feel warm, the way it sounds, the chord changes, and all of that. And it makes you very reflective. And there's a certain magic about that, that song in particular has, and the whole album does. Pardon me. But particularly that song has that ability to soothe you while it's kind of giving you maybe the bad news or maybe the reality that happens. And that's such a unique gift for a song or for an album to have. And that to me is kind of what it makes me feel like every time I hear it. And it's kind of like, it's like the song I can't turn off. Like if I hear it, I never go, oh, okay, I'll hear it later. I'm like, I got to stop what I'm doing and actually listen to the whole song, because it's, like I say, it's almost like a lullaby. It's almost very soothing. But then the lyrics, once again, are very much on point. And the relevance of those lyrics today, 50 years after it initially came out, are, once again, very relevant today, obviously on, as Inauguration Day today. It's just, it all just is full circle in a weird way.
It's uncanny. And that, I thought, was another reason that today was the day to talk about it for that very reason. Many people have said that some of the best art can come from pain. And, if you go back on Marvin's history, 69, he was in a very deep depression. He had a major breakup that he was very down about over his marriage to Berry Gordy's elder sister, Anne, I believed.
Right.
His singing partner, Tammy Terrell, that had a horrible brain cancer diagnosis.
Yep.
He had his own issues with drugs from time to time. And that, from all of that, he has said, he would say later in trying to explain the brilliance of that album and the inspiration behind that album, that was all part of it. That is, I think, why the cliche is true. Some of the best art can come from great pain.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And if you think about the album as a whole, the whole album from start to finish is amazing to me. But I always think about now, as we're talking about climate change, we're talking about global warming. He was talking about Mercy, Mercy Me, the ecology 50 years ago. And, once again, when you talk about the relevance of lyrics, even as today, I can tell you that when we did, Rhythm Nation with Janet, there would be no Rhythm Nation without What's Going On, because that album sent the template of, to me, what a great commentary album should be. And we didn't by no means achieve that, but it was certainly the inspiration for what we tried to do with Rhythm Nation. So, I mean, it's just the most important album to me that's ever been made. And also my favorite album, because sometimes there's a difference. It's like, if you think about a movie, sometimes there's a movie that's like a really great movie, as cinematically and all the things, but it doesn't necessarily make you feel, you don't walk out enjoying it or whatever. It's two kind of separate things. But that album, What's Going On, that song and that album, just to me, really make me feel so good, but it's also reality. And sometimes reality doesn't make you feel good, right? You're looking for escape. That song combines the both feelings.
Another thing to me, and now we're talking about the album beyond the title song, that is so amazing and is why it's my favorite, is at different points, I can love a different song the most for a period of months at a time, or maybe weeks at a time. This album is that deep.
Yes. And you're right, because there's so many layers to the album. And if you think about just the technicality of the making of the album, you know, this was still in the Motown days where you still had the Funk Brothers doing a lot of the rhythm section stuff. So you had, you know, the best bassist, the best guitarist, the best percussionist, the best drummer. You had all of the best musicians kind of coming together to do this. And it was almost done a little bit in a renegade fashion, because Berry Gordy hadn't really allowed Marvin to actually produce his own songs at that point. He didn't let Stevie Wonder produce his own songs up to a certain point. So there was a kind of a newness and a freshness to the approach of making the album. And when you listen to it now, when you mention the different songs become your favorite songs, part of that is because there's so many layers. There might be a vibraphone part or a tambourine part or something that you've never noticed before, and somebody will point it out to you and say, oh, I love the way the vibes mix with the piano there. And you go, oh, really? And now you listen to it again with, like, through new ears. And so the music discovery portion of that record is deep, and is only going to get deeper to you the more that you hear it, which is amazing when music can be like that.
The start of Inner City Blues. You're the music guy, and you could probably diagram it more and help us understand it there that way. I'm just talking about from the gut. The start of that song is unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like magic. It's kind of like, probably not a great analogy, but you know, when you see a trick in it, a magic trick that a magician does, and it absolutely blows you away when you you kind of think, man, wow, that was really good. I wonder how he did it. And then sometimes the magicians actually do show you how they do it. And when they show you how they did it, and now you know how they did it, you're even more blown away with the execution of it. Because my son Max says this all the time. He says the genius in something isn't the idea, it's the execution of the idea. And so if you think about what's going on, and you think about Inner City Blues and all the elements in that song, if you can listen to it and not know why you like it or why it makes you feel the way it does, and absolutely love it. But when you dig into it and you pull, there's a lot of the tracks you can get in different places where, you know, the tracks are all stripped down, so you can hear just the strings or just the percussion or just the whatever, and you hear the elements that go into it, you're still just as blown away with the execution of it as the way that it makes you feel. And that, to me, that's true magic.
And, you know, the story's been told many times before, and we've talked about over the years when we've talked about the album and the song, that Gordy had to be almost forced into. He did not want Marvin to go down this stridently political a road because of what had come before. And basically a lot of the work, as you said, was almost being done kind of in a renegade fashion behind the scenes, to the point where they end up with a 45 single almost behind his back. And it's immediately a success. And he, of course, I mean, Barry has talked about this in later years that, yeah, I wasn't crazy about it. And I had to admit, you know, I was wrong. It's a stroke of genius.
Yeah, I got a chance to talk with Berry Gordy last year. I do a show on SiriusXM called The Jimmy Jam Show, if anybody likes to. It's a podcast also, but you can, but he talked about that specifically, and he said it was more about his reputation, because he had this reputation as kind of a lover and that kind of thing. And that was the thing he was scared of. Because I had asked him, the rumor that I had heard was that there was the production end of it. He wasn't sure that Marvin could produce the records. And he did a couple of songs with a group called The Originals, Baby I'm For Real, and I can't remember the other song. And it was almost, I always heard that it was kind of like him going, when the songs ended up being hit records, that he was like, okay, Barry, can I produce now? Do you think I'm okay to produce? And that was a thing. So, but Barry knew, you know, I like the fact that he allowed the artists to eventually to be artists.
Yep.
And if you think about, you know, the Marvin Gaye that was, you know, before what's going on and the one after, it's almost like a whole different chapter. And it's very much like Stevie Wonder. If you look at the early records that Stevie Wonder did and then look at the things he did, you know, after Music of My Mind, and those records, which set him on the path to to true greatness. So I don't know, man. There's always, you know, the stars aligning or whatever you want to use for the analogy. But this record for Marvin was definitely that record and set the tone for everything that he did after. And I think also opened Berry Gordy up to let the artists, it kind of changed the idea of the Funk Brothers and kind of that studio setting. It's like, let people do kind of what they do.
I don't know. You know, there's a lot of stuff that gets tossed around because it's such a legendary album, and how much of it is true, how much of it has become part of the legend, I guess we'll never know. And a lot of times people don't care because it's fun to think about entertaining. Because one of the stories was that the brilliant bassist, James Jamerson, on the title track, on What's Going On, that he arrived drunk one day and recorded his parts while lying on the floor. I don't know if that's true, but I like it. I tend to think it's possible with Jamerson because it seemed like everything was possible, as talented as he was.
Totally possible. I've heard that same thing. I don't know whether it's actually true or not, but it makes for a great story. And, you know, think about that. I mean, that's the thing. Anything that generates, speculation and conjecture and all kinds of things about it, you know, it's bigger than life. It's bigger than music. It's just elevated to a whole different level that people have the curiosity about it. But the bottom line is, as we've all said here today and will continue to say, when you put that record on, the way that record makes you feel is unmatched. And whether you can figure it out, whether from a technical aspect, from a, you know, all the different things, whether somebody's on the floor drunk playing, it doesn't matter, because at the end of the day, when that record comes on, man, it gives you a feeling like none of it.
We're running really late. I've got Richard Pitino, but I want to try to squeeze in this, because you had mentioned to me when we had texted back and forth that you did a remake with Kenny Smith's daughter. What is that story all about?
So this was probably, I want to say, maybe 4 years ago. Kenny was coach of my son's AAU basketball team, along with his son, Kenny Smith's son, who plays for North Carolina now. And my son ended up going to Arizona State. His son went to North Carolina. And but he had called me and said, hey, my daughter wants to redo What's Going On. Would you guys, you know, like to do it or take a shot at it or whatever? And we just did it. And I don't even know, honestly, what happened with it, whether it came out, didn't come out. I don't know what happened. But I do remember her coming in and doing it. And we tried to, you know, as best we could. It's one of those songs that's impossible to really do justice to. But I thought we did a pretty good version of it and enjoyed the process of doing it. But I'll have to hunt around and see if it ever even came out. I think they might have done a video, and it maybe had something to do with maybe something they were doing at TNT, maybe over Martin Luther King Day or something. But I know there was another piece to it. I just know we did it. We did it really fast. And it came out really good. And then his daughter is a very talented singer. So,
well, keep the music going and keep sending songs to me. As you did the other day, I think you sent me the video, which I much appreciated. Yep. Get a little early taste, and definitely we'll hope to talk. If not sooner, we'll talk when the album comes out and get into some other things as well. I really appreciate the time today, because I know you kind of had to wedge some things in and had a lot of stuff going. But I thank you, as always, for giving us some really fascinating things to think about regarding just such a great album and song. And as you said, it sounds trite, but it does almost seem more timely today than when it was first produced.
Yeah, absolutely right. Well, Dan, thanks for reaching out to me. I'm glad you thought of me on this day, on this historic day, and also for that historic song. We share that in common. And I always love a chance to talk to the hometown folks. So
always a pleasure. Thanks, Jimmy. Be well. Stay safe.
Okay. You guys.
Thanks, man. That is Jimmy Jam Harris, kind enough to join us. We're running really late. We got Richard Pitino, bottom of the hour. We'll try our
On the Fan.
Rich Pitino, kind enough to join us on a very busy Wednesday afternoon on the program. Pat Kessler all over the inauguration story in the 5 o'clock hour. We just got done chatting with Hall of Fame award-winning music producer Jimmy Jam about the 50th anniversary of his favorite album of all time and mine called What's Going On. The single was released apparently on this date. Richard Pitino, we talked about a lot of things over the years. I don't know if we've ever talked music. Are you a big music guy, and who is in Richard Pitino's music wheelhouse?
I love music. I would say that I'm actually pretty well-rounded. Like, I can go older, I can go new. My mom is a big, like, that genre that you're talking about there. Like, I get, like, once every couple of days, like, a Marvin Gaye, like, YouTube video, or, like, Whitney Houston or something like that. I mean, I'm kind of a, you know, like, I love Dave Matthews Band, that era. That was kind of me growing up. But I absolutely love music and love it all, really. I really do. I mean, I don't love heavy metal would be the only thing I don't really love.
So, I'm with you, actually, on that. When you are trying to slow everything down, like your head's going, 150 miles per hour, whether it's because of something you're frustrated with your team or something at home, whatever it might be, how does Richard Pitino slow everything down? Is it reading something? Is it sitting in a corner and meditating? Is it listening to anything but heavy metal? What how do you do that?
Alcohol, normally. No. I would say, yeah, I mean, getting off of, like, I've gotten off of Twitter for a little bit, and it's not like I'm totally off of it. That really helps. And it's not even that, like, that's not the anti, like, hate what people have to say on it. It's just I do think the constant scrolling helps. I have gotten into podcasts a lot, and that's really helpful. And, like, random podcasts, like, that have, you know, like, maybe an interview with an actor or something.
Sure.
But I do read, like, I like getting a hard copy of a book too, because I just, I can't help myself. I'll just scroll too much and go back to certain things. So reading is definitely where I calm down. I actually have a bad habit too when nobody's around, where I'll smoke a cigar every now and then, and that really calms it down. But I can't do too much of that.
No, I can see where that could be an issue on a number of fronts. Yeah, they call, like, being on Twitter and just constantly, or even for the period you're on and you're kind of scrolling down, they call that doom scrolling. That's the term for it. And it fits. I think that's part of why it's so dangerous. Doom scrolling can be not helpful to anybody's brain.
Well, it's really designed like a casino. You know, like when you go to Las Vegas and you're not tired, and, like, you get off the plane, like, I'll go to bed early, and all of a sudden it's like 3 a.m. and you're at a blackjack table. A lot of that has to do with, you know, just that oxygen and all that's pumping in there, and social media is like that too. So getting away from the phone certainly helps me focus.
Let's talk a little bit of basketball. You were supposed to be playing tonight. Obviously, you're not. Nebraska had to postpone. And, you know, I heard you talk with Guardsy and Grimm on the Tuesday noon show about the current situation within the Big Ten. And it's, you don't have to be a basketball savant, I think, to say, well, look, you went through 8 straight games within the conference of playing ranked teams. And you, to a certain extent, then you could say you ran the gauntlet. And the fact that you get out of that gauntlet at a reasonable record, one could say, 4-4, does give you, on paper, an opportunity. But as you were talking about then, there's a trap there where then everybody relaxes and says, well, now it's all downhill because most of the teams we're playing aren't as good on paper or ranked. I understand you can't allow your team to think that way. But if we're being honest here, you will agree, I assume, there is an opportunity. The way this thing has set up, you didn't want it to go this way, to play that many great teams early, I'm sure. But it has now given you an opportunity while other teams are starting to run, in some cases, the same gauntlet that you guys did for the first 8.
Yeah, you know, I mean, certainly, I think the biggest thing as you get further and further along, so, like, for one thing, there are no easy games, but I will say as you get maybe closer to the finish line, there may be teams that are not in the hunt as much, right?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's a little bit different. So, you know, to say, like, they're all the same, certainly that's not the truth. I'd be lying if I said that. But I will say in our league, You know, it's just, I really believe there's 13 or 14 teams, and it's not a knock on Nebraska. I think Fred Hoiberg is building something. But there's legitimately 13 or 14 that believe that they can go to an NCAA tournament. And the reason why is the game has changed. The NCAA tournament has changed. It's now about the quality of your wins. And you could have a good week in our league, and all of a sudden you could say, hey, we just beat three NCAA tournament teams. Even Maryland, who we're playing, I mean, Maryland's, you know, two wins in the league are again at Wisconsin and at Illinois. So they probably still feel like they have a shot. So, yeah, I mean, it's certainly, you're trying to tell your team don't look at the number because that shouldn't matter. But so much of what a coach's job is to fight human nature and to get your players to fight that, because we can't think that way. We can't let our guard down, because I think we're a good team, but we can lose to anybody. And I think you've seen that in our league. Anybody can lose to anybody at any time. So we just got to stay focused on the task at hand.
Let's go back to maybe the days leading up to the Michigan rematch. And I think we've talked a little bit about this before. The age-old question where coaches, you know, are sometimes, whether they care to admit it or not, are surprised by what their team does in a game. Like, there's occasions I know when I've talked to coaches who said, where they've sprung an upset or they've dominated the way you guys did, and they said, you know, the 3 days before, I didn't feel it. I didn't see it from our guys. And then they come out and they play really well, and vice versa. The same thing. It can be the other way where you go, we were ready, and you come out and lay an egg. What was your feeling about the sort of the team temperament going into the game itself?
Well, it was funny. When I worked for a guy named Tim Welsh at Providence College, he was a big, you'd come back into the locker room and he'd be sitting there by himself, and you know, guys are warming up and you're like in the dog days of February, and he'd be like, how do you guys look out there? And he'd always give them kind of the BS answer, like, they look good, coach, they're ready. I mean, they're locked in. And I've gotten to a point now where I don't go out there anymore, because all I do is get mad, because a lot of guys don't love to warm up. Doesn't mean that they're not, like I've had a lot of really good players, that it's just not their thing. Yeah, I would say I was surprised, not that we won, but just the nature of which we won. I mean, we really controlled it from start to finish. Our team has been weird like that. I mean, we've had some terrific wins. I mean, blowing out Ohio State, blowing out Michigan State, blowing out, you know, Michigan was a surprise, but also the other way, you know, just down big versus Illinois, down big at Michigan. You know, so I just think somewhere in the middle is where our team lies, but I think we're getting better. I thought our defense was terrific. I think when we're good, I don't know if we're ever going to be an offensive masterpiece, but I do think that we have upside defensively, and we've shown that in our wins.
What do you do? Okay, I mean, one of the storylines, one of the good storylines out of this was the way Robbins rebounded. And again, it's a team game, but it's also about individual matchups. And he got punished in the first game. It did not go very well. Second game, obviously in the rematch, he was very good both offensively and defensively. So when you're trying to prepare your team, and I'm talking about individually, do you go to him, or do your assistants go to him with a certain approach, or do you just say, no, we're going to do the technical things we do to try to prepare a team. We're going to try to, you know, scout the other team well, remind them of what we want to do with Dickinson in terms of doubling, et cetera, and you leave kind of the emotional stuff alone. How did you handle that with him?
I would say a little bit of both. I mean, we certainly, you know, I look back at when a kid gets 28 on you, is it your pick and roll coverage? Is it your post defense coverage? Is it, you know, just allowing the ball in there? You know, I do think it's somewhat connected, but I certainly did remind Liam on several occasions that, Liam, you're the junior. Hunter Dickinson, who's a good player, is the freshman. It didn't look like that at Michigan. And I'm not saying that you need to go punch him in the mouth or throw him into the stands, but, you know, you have to physically impose your will. You're older. You've got more experience. And I think he saw that, you know, plus you're reminded so much today through, they've got so much content, on their phones and on the internet that they know that it was talked about, and Liam certainly was. And listen, if you want to be considered one of the best bigs, the beauty of our league is we're a bit of a throwback league this year, where we've got a lot of really good bigs and a lot of post play, which is, you know, the NBA's moving away from that, go show it. And I definitely thought he did, as well as our team did, imposed our will and did some unbelievable things on Dickinson to really disrupt him and bother him.
Richard Pitino is our guest, Golden Gophers men's basketball coach, back in action on Saturday against Maryland. The Nebraska game, of course, postponed. I also want to talk about Marcus Carr, because I watched the game from almost start to finish, but I did watch it early enough to hear Dan Dockich criticize Carr for taking an outside shot, which became, speaking of your favorite form of communication, Twitter, kind of a flashpoint on Twitter, where people were mad at Dockich for being that frontal, given what we all know about, you know, Carr's got some license. I would assume you would agree. He's been very effective, and you give scorers a little more license to take, quote-unquote, maybe not the best shot early in the shot clock, because you've got to take the good with the bad. But Dockich went off on it a little bit. For the rest of the game, I thought Carr was terrific as the game went on, did a lot of other things well, involved people, went to the basket, which I assume you always will prefer if it's doable because you get to the free throw line. And but it became this flashpoint where then Dockich, well, Dockich is still mad that Hoffarber beat him on the last second shot when he was coaching Indiana. So you're in the middle of this. I doubt you ever love to hear analysts criticize players, but how do you handle that sort of thing? Are you bothered by it? Because I tried to say, look, Dockich, I don't always agree with him. I often disagree with him. But I think he was just trying to make a point. That's the way he goes about his business. And when Carr did a number of other things, he lauded him endlessly. So what do you make of all that from afar?
Well, I would say this. I actually really like Dan Dockich, and he's got an opinion, and he is, you know, very vocal. But if you're in that job, it probably doesn't behoove you to not have opinion and not be vocal. You know, I mean, so I certainly think he's really good. I don't mind when commentators criticize the players, because sometimes it's good to have another voice say it. But the only thing that, you know, as it pertains to Marcus, which you don't love, is, you know, at one point Marcus maybe took a questionable shot and he says, well, that's selfish. Well, I don't think it's selfish. You know, Marcus is one of the best players, I believe, in the Big Ten, and if not the country. And if I'm going to give him the freedom from time to time, because he can hit tough shots that maybe I won't give other players. And that takes time. You know, he's been in the program for 3 years. They're not all going to be treated the same. And I think they got to know that and be okay with that. But I do think that Marcus, when Marcus is good, he is absolutely driving to the basket. He's absolutely getting other shots and doing a lot of great things. So I don't mind when guys are being critical of it. But you know, I also, our fans and everybody need to understand, like, I'm going to roll with Marcus Carr. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not going to teach Marcus with the bench. We've gotten past that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if he's tired, I'm going to pull him. But there's a trust factor here with both of us where – we understand that. And I tell you what, you know, I'm not so sure Marcus has the year that he has if he's looking over at the bench concerned about maybe taking a risk from time to time.
Later during the broadcast, as I'm sure you heard, Dockich then said that your dad had just texted him about something. I don't remember what it was. Believable? I mean, because your dad's got nothing, you know, I mean, he's got to stay involved, right, one way or another. So does that sound about right?
I wouldn't be surprised with it. I don't know what my dad texted him, but he's been, like, shut down from COVID for, like,
yeah.
I don't think they've played a game since the end of December. So it's 100% believable. But I will say, big time out of the Louisville Rick Pitino playbook was, if a commentator criticized a player, when we were watching the film, and we'd be watching the film as a team, and there'd be no volume, and then all of a sudden, magically, Jay Billis would pop up criticizing, like, Russ Smith's shot selection. He loved that. So I'm sure he loved that. I think Dan does a really good job. I also think Marcus Carr is a terrific player. So, you know, to me, I don't have a problem with guys trying to do their job. And like I said, I mean, I don't want a boring guy out there by any means. I mean, you're not good at your job if you're not getting people talking. So, I'm just glad we got the win. That was what I was excited about. And Dan's always been good to me. I mean, every time we've had Dan, we've gotten like blown out by 20, so I was happy to be on the other side of it for a change.
Philosophical question that goes back to your Tuesday show. You guys are talking about Eric Curry and that he seems healthier than he's been and can be a really, now I think you described him as a very helpful complementary player, role player at this point, which is great given all the injuries he's come out of. And one of the things you said about him is he's one of those guys who literally is about, okay, how can I help the team? I want to win, so I am here to contribute in any way that I can. And you mentioned that not everybody is necessarily wired like that. So when you have players who aren't wired that way and might want to make it a little bit more about themselves, what do you do with them? I mean, is it the old, hey, look, a lot of times that means those are the more talented guys, and we got to have talented guys, so I got to roll with it a little bit. But how quickly do you know about a player in that regard, that he is more than anything else interested in team or more interested in individual?
Well, I know when I say hello to them because they're all interested in the individual first. I think one of the things that you're seeing with Eric Curry is he's at the tail end of his career. He knows that he's not going to play in the NBA. He knows that he's not going to play overseas. You know, depending on how long he sticks it out with us, you know, hopefully we can keep him along at some capacity like we've done with Andre Hollins and Jarvis Johnson and those guys. So I think a lot of that has to do with he's past all that. They're all, and this is going to sound really bad, they're all selfish to a certain extent. I want to win because it advances my career, mm-hmm. and it stabilizes my career. So does that make me selfish? Of course it does. But the bottom line is what you got to get them to understand is if they win, they can get what they want. It's that chicken or the egg, but it's become increasingly challenging, and it's challenging at this level because, like, when I was at the University of Florida, I had come right after they won back-to-back titles. So in recruiting, you kind of have your stump speech about what it is that you talk about. And I remember rarely talking about back-to-back national titles. And I remember talking over and over again about Corey Brewer and Al Horford and Joe Kim Noah and all these pros that came out of the program. It's what they want. And that's okay. You know, Marcus Carr is an elite-level point guard who wants to play at the next level. Well, my point to Marcus is, hey, how do we get you out there looking good, shooting a high percentage, have a, you know, high assist to turnover ratio, and help us win? If you help us win, it puts us on a stage that people are talking about you. Like, we've had some good wins. I've gotten Jim Rome show. I've gotten podcasts. Obviously, I'm on your show. If you lose, nobody wants to talk about you. And so how do we put these players in a position where they're a part of a winning program, and they're playing the right way, and that helps them flourish? So they're all self-absorbed to a certain standpoint. This whole world is, and that's okay. How can we help each other out and be a partnership? Because they're not going to be all about the team first. They want to see where it can get them. So it's going to be a kind of a give and take where you don't sacrifice your principles as a coach because you believe that this can help you win and that can make them look good in the end. And I really am okay with that.
As we wrap up here, if you accept the premise, and I don't know that you would, but for the sake of this question, please try to, that you've got, you know, Robin's going in the right direction right now, and you had Marcus Carr is always going to be or close to the right direction, or he's certainly an important part of this thing. If I said to you, okay, blank as a third piece, at least offensively, is the guy I really would like to see us get going to maybe help us take another positive step, who would that be?
Brandon Johnson. I think Brandon Johnson, another, you know, dimension to his game, and he's finally getting healthy. That is not to say that, like, I think Gabe Kalscher now is a junior. Like, everybody talks about him, the three-point shooting. Like, Gabe is a phenomenal defender, probably the best in the league on the ball. He is getting better and better at driving to the basket. He had some unbelievable cuts, some great passes. Like, Gabe is what he is. Will he make a couple more threes? Absolutely. Booth Gotch, I think, is what he is. Do I think he can get a couple easier baskets? For sure. But I think there's another dimension to Brandon, whether it's in the post or whether it's kind of off the block, where we can really get him going to be kind of that next piece. Because, you know, he really was hobbled early but he's shooting a great percentage from the field. He's shooting a great percentage, you know, from the three-point line as well. I keep talking to our guys about, hey, guys, let's look at the percentages, and let's make sure those guys that are shooting a decent amount of shots, let's make sure they're getting the right shots, because all of us, our percentages need to go up. But I do think there's another level to Brandon that we can get out of him.
Excellent conversation. I appreciate the time, as always. Thanks for not being too bitter with the delay. And best of luck this weekend. We'll try to stay in touch as this thing winds down.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. That is Richard Pitino, the Golden Gophers men's basketball coach. Always a good discussion with him, and another good one, I think, today. The 5 o'clock hour will include very much about Inauguration Day today. Kessler described, I don't know if he described himself as special correspondent or Channel 4 is describing him as special correspondent, but he apparently is going to play that role tonight in their coverage on the inauguration.
The text I got from him said he was special correspondent. So
maybe Don Shelby gave him that name. No, Don Shelby would be a special correspondent.
He would be a very special correspondent.
Probably
the most special correspondent.
So that's coming up in the 5 o'clock hour. Top 5 at 5. First, do the Minnesota Twins make a big move?
Stove is hot. Can you feel it? Don't touch the stove.
White Sox, devastated.
Stove is super hot, and one of my guys is hanging them up.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I wish the American media would take a great look at the views of the people in Congress and find out, are they pro-America or anti-America?
Pat Kessler.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook. Well, I'm not a crook.
I can't trust Obama. He's an Arab.
Pat Kessler.
Tear down this wall.
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
Pat Kessler.
Who would have thunk that?
Now, to help Dan break down all the tough questions in politics, it's our own
Pat Kessler
Political Wonk.
I feel like a supermodel, except like times 10.
It's Channel 4's
Pat Kessler
with Dan Barrero on The Fan.
It's been a great run. What a great life. What a great state.
Of all the pardons by the now departed President Donald J. Trump, this one in particular caught my attention, Pat Kessler. Are you familiar with a former all-time great Chicago Bears linebacker named Brian Urlacher?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He wasn't on the list, was he?
No, but his brother was on the list. In fact, let me see if I can find his first name.
Oh, my.
Casey Urlacher apparently was a mayor of some small Chicago suburb. I don't remember which one. Here it is. He's a mayor of the tiny Lake County suburb of Mettawa. I've never even heard of it. Mettawa, Illinois. And the president has apparently pardoned him after he pleaded not guilty to federal charges alleging he acted as a recruiter. And this will sound strange coming out of the state of Illinois from a politician, bagman, for a sports gambling ring that raked in millions of dollars from hundreds of Chicago area bettors. So he's out. He's done. He doesn't have to worry about it anymore. Casey Urlacher. And apparently, the Inkstain wretches in Chicago have found an occasion when Brian Urlacher was seen by White House reporters on the West Wing, basically, like, what's Urlacher doing there? And the president didn't say. We now know, apparently, that maybe there was a little bit of wheel greasing being done, and he ends up being, I don't know how many pardoned, you probably have that number, Brian Urlacher's brother among those pardoned by the departed president.
Yeah, that's pretty remarkable, and the president did issue 143 commutations and pardons. I think it was 73 pardons and 70 commutations.
Okay.
That one I wasn't familiar with, but that's a good one because it does fall in line with a lot of the other kinds of celebrity pardons he's done in the past.
But not the Tiger King. He didn't pardon the Tiger King, right?
Yeah, he did not.
What happened there?
Well, somebody, I don't know who the lawyer was, Giuliani must not have been that person's lawyer. But I thought for sure Joe Exotic was going to be what was going to be pardoned. Now, I don't know if this is true, but I kept seeing all over Twitter that someone had hired, maybe Joe himself, hired a limo to take him out of prison when he got the pardon. It's like, oh, my goodness.
Oh, boy.
Oh, but, you know, your guy Bannon
got
a pardon.
Right.
And that's among the sleaziest of charges filed.
Right.
Trying to milk donors for $5 and $10 to build a wall to help build the president's Mexico border.
Sounds
wall
swampy.
That Mexico was supposed to pay for. Yeah,
sounds a little swampy to me, but that's just me.
Oh my God!
All right, so it's inauguration day, and you know, I think now we're down to a couple of parties and concert, and then Springsteen's going to perform, and a number of, I think Tom Hanks is presiding over the
A-list,
big pep rally.
A-list
it's
Hollywood.
Quite an A-list, but let's go back to the start of the day, and the start of the day is with the most recently departed president making sure he got out of Dodge ahead of the swearing-in ceremony. How did all that go?
Well, it went fantastic if you're Donald Trump. Now, can I just say this now? Are we going to miss this guy with all of the kinds of stuff that he did, all of the stunts, whether you liked it or not? Oh, my goodness, it just filled up our days. But he left the White House, did not say anything, did not call President Biden, as is traditional. Of course, he did not attend the inauguration swearing in. All the other former presidents, but for Jimmy Carter, who's 96 and ailing, were there. And the president had a little send-off ceremony that he himself choreographed. I mean, he had all the flags. He was trying
music
to get hundreds, maybe thousands of people there, but hardly anybody showed up.
Nobody showed up, yeah.
It was kind of sad, a little bit. Kind of sad. And he ad-libbed a speech, and it was, by President Trump's standards, it was fairly straightforward. He ripped Biden a little bit, not by name. He aired a few grievances, felt bad for himself. And then he ended this rally of the transfer of power in this great democracy, this sacred thing we call democracy, by playing YMCA as he left the stage.
Yeah, I was trying to figure
YMCA
out.
YMCA.
I kind of get, as Air Force One's taken off, Sinatra's My Way.
That's
but
the best one of all.
Why YMCA? I guess it's a standard pep rally song, like like it's some sort of another political rally. But I was having trouble understanding what message that was supposed to send.
Well, there's no message other than the CBS News is reporting that the president did direct the playlist for this send-off today.
Right. Yeah.
So these are the kinds of songs, and I think you and I have talked about this a number of times. I've been at many different Trump rallies, and they play this fantastic classic rock playlist, and they play it at 10, they crank it up to 11, so you can't hear yourself talk, and very loud music. And that is what a lot of times he ends his rallies on. And this was a rally like, I suppose, any other. And in the last year, he does a little Trump dance. But the best part was that he choreographed, like a reality TV show, the takeoff of Air Force One as he heads off in the sunset. And it was time. So Frank Sinatra, My Way, fantastic. I did it my way. As the Air Force One is taking off for the last time, oh, my God. It was, I was teary-eyed.
As I understand it, he is the first president to skip the incoming inauguration in 151 years. You can do the math on it if I'm right. So that means 1869, I think. Who was it who skipped, and why did he skip? Do we know the historic footnote there?
Yeah, first of all, this is a disgrace. If you are an outgoing president, no matter how you lose, you got to suck it up and show up at this event. And this is for the sake of the country and for the sake of democracy, not for the sake of airing your own grievances and taking your ball and going home.
Wait. So are you trying to tell me that it shouldn't just be about him? Is that what you're intimating?
Yeah, I was tiptoeing around that.
Okay. Let's say it straight out. I mean, this was,
I think, disgraceful. Everybody should show up, and the president should be there.
Correct.
Now, he is not going to be a member of the president's club, the ex-president's club, but he could have been. He could have been somebody, but he's never reached out, not even once, to Bill Clinton, to George Bush, to Barack Obama, to Jimmy Carter, none of them. Because he doesn't care. Now, the last one, as you mentioned, was Andrew Johnson, and he had been impeached, and he also was pretty upset when he was defeated by your guy in that fantastic campaign, Ulysses S. Grant. So Grant, who is one of the best presidents America has ever had, takes over the presidency from Andrew Johnson, who, as some historians say until now, was the worst president America ever had. So this did not feel right this morning. Looking at it, I felt bad for the president. I actually did for President Trump, that he felt like he had to do it this way because it just didn't have to be this way.
No, it didn't, but I'm not. I don't think anybody is all that surprised. We're not.
But I just never thought he would actually go through it. I do want to say this. He did leave a note, we find out, for President Biden in the Oval Office. So he has carried on that tradition. And President Biden revealed during the last hour that he has read the contents of this note, and he said that it was very generous. And that he was not going to reveal the contents until he's actually had a chance to talk with President Trump in Florida. So I don't know when that will ever be. But so there at least is that. I'm interested to see what that note says.
Let's get a break in. I got a lot more to get to with you, and I know your time, all of a sudden, all the promises you had, hey, all the time in the world, if you want me, because I'm retired now, and now suddenly every 15 minutes you're a special correspondent again.
Suddenly, what am I again? A special correspondent?
Well, yeah, I mean, that sounds like it's self-designated on your part, A, and B, I think it strips bare the facade that you retired, that all the big buildup about the retirement, all the Q&As you had, it's all nonsense. You haven't retired at all.
Well, now, wait a second.
Yeah.
Wait a second here. I told them I would. I'm not coming back unless if you want me back, it's going to have to be something really big, like I don't know, insurrection.
Yeah, right. And then that happened.
Violent insurrection, overthrowing the U.S. Capitol.
Right.
That or an inauguration that where 25,000 troops had to protect it. Those were my only two conditions.
For how much longer, though? For how much longer can you put off those art history courses?
Okay, I'm telling you what, I looked it up. I'm looking it up, and
the semester has already started. You're going to have to do a spring class or a summer school.
The Great Impressionists class is already, they're in their sixth week already. You're not going to be able to catch up.
Oh, the ventriloquist, Great Impression?
Something like that, yeah. Let's get a break in because you don't have four more minutes.
God.
So we'll pause for the bottom of the hour. We'll get to more about Inauguration Day, about the Biden speech, about a couple of other events related to the inauguration.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.